A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, we're online and we're on your smart speaker. Coming up, shockingly, a quarter of the UK's foreign aid budget is spent on housing asylum seekers and refugees. Plus, the rise of the suburban sick note. Every part of Britain has seen a rise in incapacity benefit claims, with some of the largest increases in affluent commuter towns. And a teenage rally driver beats the odds and her disability with her sights set on Formula One. Daniela Sutton will be live in the studio. Good evening, Britain, and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. We've got a belter of a show for you tonight. We'll be discussing the former American football star and acquitted murderer, O.J. Simpson, who's died at the age of 76. Plus, Boris wades in on Sunak's smoking ban plan, calling it absolutely nuts. Meanwhile, the UN's climate chief has warned there's only 2 years left to save the world. Brilliant. So, the only place to be on Earth right now is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Start your engines, put your pedal to the metal. Lights out, and away we go. Now, if you thought we spent too much time on foreign aid, new revelations show that a quarter of the budget is not going on any actual worthy foreign developments, but has been used instead on the migrant hotel programme. This scandal, which has crippled the hospitality business for years now, cost us alone about £4.3 billion. And with total migration already higher at this point of the year since the boat started coming, it looks like the spending is only going to go up and up and up. I'd like to introduce my panel for tonight, journalist and broadcaster Sam Dowler, political commentator Reem Ibrahim, and barrister and broadcaster Andrew Eborn. Such a ham, isn't he? I mean, absolutely.
How did he get his own theme tune?
I mean, he does a lot of talking behind the scenes, you know.
It's true. I can't
help you. Anyway, listen, welcome to all of you. We've only got 2 years left, so just make the most of it, is my... we'll be explaining later why the UN's latest climate craze is now being put into force. Apparently, despite the fact that we've reduced our climate emissions by 50%, it's not enough. You know, so we're all going to die anyway. So there we are. But let's talk about this money business because, you know, the Rwanda word hasn't been mentioned yet. Nobody's gone there. We're now offering people £3,000 a time to go there if they'd like to go. We're now spending millions and billions of pounds. People are being housed now permanently. We learned only yesterday, I think, that all the people who fail their asylum seeker status don't ever go away anyway. They just stay here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
And they're selling off the apartments as well that we apparently.
Oh, yes.
And so Red Suella was like, oh, well, that's a shame. So
yeah, it's like a giant pyramid scheme.
Well, I mean,
it's a get-rich-quick scheme.
Exactly, yeah. And it's mortifying. And obviously, you know, the amount of money that you just said, like the 25%, like this is money that they could have saved had they had the process in place to deal with these immigrants and to actually sort them out. But no, put them in a nice hotel. 25% of our entire, I mean, the entire budget is outrageous.
It is crazy. And the scandal is they classified as overseas aid. When the reality is, it's what, 4.3 billion, 28% of the total budget is crazy. The other side of the thing, there's a brilliant film at the moment called Il Capitan, Il Capitano, which shows actually the migrant side of it, which is the horrendous torture, the
who's
murder,
made this
blackmail.
Film?
Oh, wow.
I've seen it. And it shows their
journey. Who's made it?
Over.
Who's made the film?
I'm not sure, but it's up for all sorts of awards. Go and have a look at it. What I would say, the people we need to deal with are the people traffickers. That's the abhorrent trade in all
they're
this.
They're the criminals, and they're, you know, obviously they're the ones that we've got to compete against, right? Effectively, we need to have those safe and legal routes in order to compete with them. But actually, what's really interesting about this, and you mentioned this, Sam, is the Home Office failures.
Yeah.
Home Office waiting list for asylum seekers went from 100,000 to 170,000. Mm. The real number is probably more than that, but that was the figure as of summer last year. And we've got to have these conversations about why these policies aren't working. Now, I'm personally not very pro-Rwanda policy. I think it's a bit of a waste of money. Mm. We're giving money to a foreign
government.
We're spending huge amounts of money and then saying, actually, if you voluntarily come, you get £3,000. I mean, it is really ridiculous.
Yeah.
But we saw this week with the ECHR's commitment to this new ruling with the UN. We're talking about this, where effectively that actually this lawyer came in and said that those women in Swiss 70-year-olds were able to then get that money back and actually say that they had their human rights violated. I think silly things like that mean that there is a potential for us to leave the ECHR. Sunak has said that we might do.
The problem surely now is that the people who are here need to be put somewhere.
Yeah.
And somebody has to pay for that. And now whether we pay for their houses or whether we pay for their... asylum seeking. I think there's 34 million. I think that might be the answer.
But
the problem is at the moment, we have to, they're here already. I'm not so concerned about the people who are not here yet. Mm. I'm more concerned about the ones who are here.
But the money is going on the illegal immigrants. That's the point. It's not, which is a tiny percentage of net migration to this country.
But £several billion.
So tell me why they haven't, in all this time, they haven't managed to get enough people to process. They haven't managed to, they keep talking about all the gangs. But where is the progress? Where is anything? Tell us something good. They just stand there going, oh, Rwanda, that's the answer.
No,
but it clearly isn't.
And not one person has gone to Rwanda.
No, but
hang on. The problem is not necessarily with the government here. The problem is with the civil service, because they clearly, at the Home Office, do not want to process anybody. Because if they wanted to do stuff, they could have done it. There's plenty of people working there. They're just not doing anything. What does it take them 1 week to process one person?
If the government wanted them to do it quicker, then they could have.
Look at all the different Home Secretaries that have come in, and Sarah Braverman is the one who said she knows the Home Office better than anybody. She was a lawyer in the Home Office. She'll make it work. She couldn't make it work. Priti Patel couldn't make it work.
Is it that civil servants themselves are against the government's migration?
I think that's part of it. They don't want to do the job. And they know very well that if they don't bother actually processing the cases, they'll just stay anyway.
They're putting their feet up in the offices and they're not in going
office.
Like, meh.
They're all at home. 90% of the work.
Well, that's what they say. The Home Office spend, which rose by £559 million in 2023. That's the crazy thing. Rwanda's a distraction. They can only process 200 people. So it's nonsense. You look at the figures that they have on sort of that sort of side.
Yeah, forget about Rwanda. I'm going to ban the word.
Exactly.
We're not saying it anymore because Rwanda's not the story.
Yeah.
The story is the people that are here
who
are going absolutely nowhere. Yeah. Except they're now being moved out of hotels into housing, which is being purchased by the government.
And they're not allowed to work.
And which has been given to them for free.
I think there's a real scandal about this story.
What would you give them to do, though?
A lot of them have tried to work illegally in the gig economy.
Or maybe they could use their own skills. I mean, we can't say that, they're only good for cleaners or they're only good for doing
this.
Like, a lot of them will have their own skills.
It is currently illegal for those people on asylum. They're effectively in limbo. They're not allowed to work. Their asylum seeker application hasn't been processed. I would say it's much better for those individuals to be allowed to be given the right to work. I have no issue with an asylum seeker on a waiting list delivering my takeaways, to be completely honest.
Well, guess what?
Fine.
They already are. I mean, remember, they rounded up 20 delivery drivers down in Brighton a few months ago, and they were all illegal.
And that's the problem. You need to keep track of these things and also put the figures in perspective. They're talking about the Home Office spent $8 million a day last year.
$8 million
a day, absolutely crazy.
Right.
There's a safety in certain things about giving people jobs. You do need a sort of net migration and so on and so forth to make sure certain jobs like care and so on and so forth are filled.
Yeah.
But we need to deal with this. The number is down, though. What they're saying is the number is down by more than 56,000 at the end of September at the Department of Housing. So there is some sort of progress. What we need to do, though, the main sort of problem
is
that...
Down, though? Number of what?
Well, what they're saying is the number... This is basically there are 20,000 fewer people staying in the accommodation than 6 months ago.
So this where have they gone?
But the
well, that's the question.
The number of people on the waiting list increased.
You know, they've just gone to some more accommodations.
They're trying to put up these temporary houses. So I was down, as you know, I was down in Cairn where they were talking about these temporary houses.
Get that in somewhere. I all the time.
I'm permanently on a holiday. It's got to go.
Actually, a proper question for you.
Yes.
How was Cairn? Because, you know, the south of France is an area which has also an immigrant problem.
Absolutely.
And what did you see?
One of the things there was a Japanese company there which would talk about actually during earthquakes and things like that, they set up temporary accommodation, which is a fraction of the cost.
But are they doing that in France?
So that's what they're looking at. It's not down in Cairns, surprise, surprise. They don't want to ruin the aesthetics.
There's a difference
between
the south of France and the south of England. You can live in a tent in Cairns, but you cannot live in a tent in Cairns.
But the reality of these hotels are far too expensive, so they're putting up temporary accommodation.
Also, again, the whole system has been ruined from point one to point ten because.
Yes.
I mean, the one I know about, North Eye, which is down in Bexhill, is a former army camp, right?
Yes.
It was taken over by Emirates Airlines for a while, used as a training base for their flight staff. They've now bought it, right? They're leasing it in order to give it put something like 1,000 migrants in it, right? But they bought it from the people that they were leasing it from. The people leased who sold it to them bought it for $7 million, sold it to the Home Office for $15 million.
Yeah, it's
so they're
crazy.
Paying through the nose for this place. It's not ready. They'll have to spend another five or six million on it before it's ready. It's ridiculous.
It's almost the same as the pandemic. Do you remember Rishi Sunak's, you know, money tree? It's like people are making
just money. Throw money
from,
at it.
People are making money from this, from selling this, from rent,
but
from rent.
It's
rentals,
another government failure. And also, let's remember this. This is taxpayer money. It's our hard-earned money. And we can't currently have almost the highest tax burden since the Second World War. We are paying through the nose in taxes.
Yeah.
Where are we seeing it in public services? Where are we seeing it in government spending that is actually impacting real people?
Yeah.
And we're looking at the way in which asylum seekers have been treated, where they are forced to be reliant on other taxpayers. Yeah. No wonder why people resent them.
And we should also look at the promises that were made. So Robert Jenrick, the former immigration officer, he said in October that they would be exiting 50 hotels by the end of January. Well, let's see if that happens.
But James Cleverly
said last Wednesday the process will continue until the last hotel is closed. So these are the promises. We need to continue to hold their feet to the fire.
Yeah, but that doesn't help anyone because all it means is that they then move these people into communities who don't want
them. That's what you need to do.
Which causes friction, causes difficulty. Yeah. And as Reem says, if they're not working anywhere, exactly what are they doing all day?
They can't process them quicker enough that more people come from behind.
And it's always the problem with the media because you're only ever reporting one side of it. So it's always about the numbers.
No, we do all sides of it here, Andrew. We do all sides of it here.
We do, absolutely.
The other thing, of course, is this week was the week that the European Parliament decided to have a sort of EU-wide agreement, which is still not really very sort of sure about how it's going to work out. But they're talking about getting better plans to move people back to their country of origin as soon as they hit Europe, which would be a big help. Because, I mean, let's face it, it's a big European problem.
Oh, it's absolutely. And you need collaboration absolutely to make that work.
And if they got deported as soon as they got to Italy or as soon as they got to Spain or Greece, that would be a beginning. That would be a huge difference.
It's totally that sort of, and this is going back to the solution, which you're brilliant at doing on this show.
I am.
And it's always been that sort of, it is looking at all sides. But the reality is that's some of the solutions. You turn around and say, make sure it's not attractive to come here.
Right.
Make sure you target the people traffickers.
Well, you know how you do that? You know how you do that? You stop giving people free stuff. I'm sorry, but the fact of the matter is the welfare state in this country is incredibly generous to people that are, let's be honest, just lazy.
Yeah.
And we've got almost 5.3 million people on out-of-work benefits in the United Kingdom. And a lot of those people, we saw the story today, that was, I think it was front page of the Times, that actually a lot of these people are claiming mental health sickness.
Yeah.
Many of these people are probably genuinely too sick to work. I believe many of those people
are. Can I just say, they work the system. I know people work in that system.
Of course,
and they do.
Yeah.
And they
come back to
down.
This, because we're running over. Remember you mentioned the five Bulgarian, guys who managed to rip £50 million off of us before
Absolutely
anybody noticed.
Yeah.
Amazing. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up next, Rishi is smoked out by Boris Johnson over his tobacco ban and Britain's big on benefits as nationwide people take up payments. Stay there. Very nice. Welcome back. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Boris Johnson has described Rishi Sunak's policies as absolutely nuts in a scathing attack on the Prime Minister. The former leader slammed plans to ban the sale of cigarettes to younger generations and called for an increase in defence spending as he addressed a Conservative conference in Ottawa. Mr. Johnson also criticised the state of the Conservative Party, suggesting it lacked the dynamism of its Canadian counterpart. Joining me now to discuss all of this, Mike Indian, political analyst, Paul Burke, author of The Spectator, and Rafe Heidel-Menku, historian and broadcaster. Good evening, gentlemen. Very nice to see you. I'm not quite sure what the connection is between smoking and defence, but, I mean, I'm sure Boris can explain it to somebody. The smoking thing is stupid, so I suppose we might as well dispense with that pretty quickly. The idea that you're going to not be able to sell cigarettes to somebody who's 40 in the future, but you can sell them to his 41-year-old mate.
But this is based
on... And you're going to ask him how close to 40 he is.
It's the New Zealand law, basically, where they increase the age of the...
But they've dumped it.
...per year as well.
And they're not even doing it.
It's... Rishi Sunak had the bold idea and now he's junked it, but... I mean, look at this 3% on defence spending, for example. Boris Johnson was Prime Minister for nearly 3 years. He didn't get anywhere near this level now. He's harping from the sidelines, carping on about what he thinks they should have done in government. Now he's out of power and he's missing a taste of what he had,
yeah,
to be honest.
But, I mean, like a lot of these people, Liz Truss was here a little bit earlier being interviewed. You know, they like to go to the North American sort of Plantagenet part of the world, don't they? Yeah. And talk about proper conservatism and why they've lost track of it all, don't they?
I think they do because... I mean, I think Boris was unlucky. Boris, like he's my mate, was unlucky with COVID. I think all Western regions were. So a lot of what they may have spent went on that. But the smoking thing, we're giving up smoking anyway as a nation. Yeah. We did it quite voluntarily, you know, with a lot of nudging.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how...
It's now more unusual to see people smoking,
it is.
Actually, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, as you know, as someone who used to live in Ottawa, let me give you... I'm a big cigar smoker, right? I'm also on the board of the Churchill Society. So
yes.
So, look, I support...
Now, where can you smoke that cigar in London?
So, well, I supported Boris when he refused to ban smoking in parks and public squares, which is one of the few places you can do that, apart from in club gardens and so forth. But actually, this is the first time I'll say this, I support Rishi Sunak on this policy.
Right.
Because nobody who smokes today is going to actually ever be affected by this policy. And if you smoke today, you'll smoke to the day you die. Mm. But I don't think there's a single parent in this country who would want their child to start smoking. And that's what this policy affects. And in fact, the majority of cigarette smokers in this country wish that they had never started and want to quit.
But that's always been the case. And I think, I'm afraid the problem is that, you know, I think I had my first cigarette when I was about 11, you know, because my mother used to smoke, you know. My kids now don't have parents who smoke, but... Kids will find ways of doing things. You know, it might as well say you're not allowed to smoke marijuana. They're not allowed to take drugs. They're not allowed to have a drink before they're over the age of 18. They do all of it.
And they sort of don't, because it looks so weird. You see old programmes like The Sweeney and they're smoking Parkinson. It just looks really weird.
Yeah.
But we still make it look cool, though, don't we?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think we could make it.
My only concern is I don't want it to affect premium tobaccos, so pipes and cigars. Yeah. That's a very different experience than having...
Yeah, but can you answer that question? Where in London can you smoke your cigar? I mean, apart from outside.
If you go to private members' clubs, you can still smoke.
Right.
You can actually smoke in cigar shops, because if you're purchasing a cigar... You're allowed to sample it. So you can sample cigars. But yes,
I used to smoke a lot. I actually filmed a promo for this show, which I think they may be able to show you. There's a cigar in my mouth there. But the promo for the show, they wanted me to light a cigar with some money, which was actually my money. And I said, well, I might as well smoke it properly. And it was horrible.
I used to forget that I didn't like cigars.
It was ghastly.
Like, you'd be somewhere years ago and one would come around. Oh,
yeah, have some of that.
I forgot, I hate these.
Yes, they're awful. One of the times I tried
to
smoke those little thin cigars, you know, I was working in Fleet Street. Yeah. And we went to the pub at lunchtime, as you did, and I ended up smoking all six of them in the space of about 2 hours drinking. And it was awful, absolutely horrendous.
We'll go for a drink one day, we can smoke inside a couple of places I know, and then we'll see. Yeah. We'll see what you think.
I mean, I think my lungs have also sort of changed, because if I try to smoke anything, I can't. It's like I couldn't even hold the smoke in. You know, I smoked for probably 35 years.
It's like Angel Delight, isn't it? You couldn't eat that now either.
No, absolutely not.
Butterscotch Angel Delight.
No, let's talk about Benefits Britain, because we're now saying that every constituency in the country now has got a rise in the numbers of people claiming benefits, and higher in some of the places where you might consider them to be sort of slightly better off commuter towns, for example. Now, I wonder if a lot of this is related to the working from home brigade and the whole COVID situation, where people stopped thinking they had to go to work.
Well, specifically, it's about the increase in capacity benefit, and this reflects the fact we've had a record rise in the number of people that are, to use that horrible phrase, economically inactive due to poor health. And
if
we look at the increase, it's happening for the over 50s, but also the under 25s as well, especially due to poor mental health. And actually, I was in Coventry earlier, and that's seen the sharpest rise by percentage in this as well. But also, we're seeing it in Tory commuter towns too. Britain is facing a sickness epidemic here, and it's partly because of the fact that we were told during lockdown to stay inside, protect the NHS, but we weren't told to protect ourselves.
Right.
And actually, our health as a nation has suffered as a result of this, and we're still reaping the dividends years later as a result.
Is that an NHS problem, though, more than it is a...
I could never understand that. Problem. Yeah. That protect the NHS... Sorry, isn't it the other way round?
Yes.
When they set up to protect us. I'd ask the question, how many of these people, I don't want to say, but are in the public sector?
Yeah.
Because I think... In fact, I know...
It's a lot easier to get time off in the public sector.
Oh, my God, yeah.
But it's also quite easy to get time off in the private sector. I mean, I know people who, during COVID, hired people to come into work, but they never actually came into the office. Mm. And they now no longer work because they were asked to come into the office.
You're going to any coffee shop on a Friday or a Monday.
Yeah.
Absolutely mobbed.
Well, funnily enough, my son's up visiting me today from Sussex, and we were just walking around London Bridge, and it's so busy on a Thursday night. Because Thursday night is the new Friday.
It is, yeah.
Every pub is rammed. There's people all over the streets. Mm. There's people having a great time. The weather's nice and warm. I said, tomorrow, there'll be none of this. And it's really weird now in London, where Fridays and Mondays, the nightlife is just dead.
But this is all happening at the same time when it's never been easier to work from home. And yet there are, you know, if we went back to pre-pandemic levels, there would be a million fewer people on benefits and sick in this country. Mm. And yes, a lot of it is genuine, but also I think we've diluted the meaning of mental health. And I think many people who are simply not in the best of moods are claiming mental health benefits. And two-thirds of claimants don't actually need to find a job.
I mean, that's a subjective judgment, based on the requirements.
There are 6 million people who are economically inactive. Now, you're not going to tell me that
there's 2.7 million people that are economically inactive in this country, up from 2.1 million about... pre-pandemic.
Well, there's 6 million people who are classified by the National Audit Office as economically inactive.
Yes, but one of the issues that we do face as a country is that, unfortunately, people's health habits have changed. I mean, look, it's easy to work from home if you're in a white-collar job, but unfortunately, one of the things we have had is a lot of people now that, say, work in service industries come into work, but they haven't been able to find jobs because, you know, particularly in central London, for example.
London's mobbed. I don't see it busier. People are coming into work
Fridays
when
Mondays,
they feel like
it's quieter.
Yeah, because they're working from home.
Exactly.
It's not that they're not working.
But it's not mobbed every day of the week. This is the reason that Sadiq Khan's just cut the tube fares in the capital on Friday.
But you're also ignoring the fact that it's the youth of today who have the most evidence of mental health sickness, which is a complete contrast.
Actually, it's men in their 30s that have the most evidence of that.
I just checked this before I came out.
Is it evidence or is it just...
And the problem is, of course, is that we have coddled children for so long. You know, we have one-child families where kids are actually pampered far too much. They have unrealistic expectations about the work life. They go to the work world. They're not prepared for that. They can't do the work. They're not getting the rewards and the lifestyle that they're expecting to get. Added to that, we've now seen a doubling in depression because of things like social media and smartphones and so forth. And, of course, you know, I've said in the past, Swedish kids are the most privileged in the world, and yet they were the ones who reported the highest level of depression. Why? Because they're always being asked about their mental health. Mm. How do you rank yourself on a grade of 1 to 10? If people are constantly obsessing about mental health, they're going to report higher levels of mental health, and they're going to misinterpret having a bad day.
The government isn't helping them, because the government has just passed yet another law for employers who say that as soon as you start your first day on the job, you're entitled to ask for flexible working.
It's the right to request flexible working.
Well, it's not the right thing to do, because the problem is that we have an economy which is dying on its arse, right? The reason it's dying on its arse is there's no growth. Nobody's doing anything which is creating any growth. People are looking for excuses not to work. People want a work-life balance now. When I was going into work first, you went into work because you wanted to make money. You wanted to make something of yourself. Now people go into work in order to have a nice work-life balance. It's a different mentality.
I don't know why they don't force them, but mandate that. Mm. Because
offices are asking people to return to work.
No, not asking.
Civil service has gone to 3 days a week.
Yeah, but it shouldn't be a choice, though. That's my point.
Well, it's not required now. If you're a civil servant, sometimes you have to be in office 3 days a week now.
The civil servant should be in the office 5 days a week. No excuses. They work for us. The country relies on them.
And considering the state of most of the departments of state, if you like, you know, the Home Office has got a massive backlog of asylum seekers, right? For example, they say it takes them a week to process one of them. Now, if they were all at work 5 days a week in an office, maybe it would speed up a bit.
I'd be a little more sympathetic to the government if they hadn't sold off all the office space in central London.
But they haven't.
Couldn't accommodate.
The Home Office is sitting there completely empty. They haven't sold it off.
There is capacity to bring them back in. To bring it back.
Well, you just said they'd sold it all off.
Well, they have sold a lot of the office space off. If every civil servant that was based virtually in central London came in, they can't house them. They have to do hot desking.
But if you work freelance, it's particularly galling because as a freelancer, you can work where you like.
You get sick a lot less than you're freelance.
Yeah,
I've found.
Dr. Freelance.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. But we put up with all sorts of things. Yeah, we've got freedom, but we've got no pension, no work, no... Right. And these people want all our benefits. They want to, they will go and work in coffee shops and work-life balance, but they still want the regular salary, the pension, and they make me sick.
Yeah, well, exactly right.
Not literally.
Because
sick,
those people...
those people who actually work hard
for a living because they want to make something of themselves, because they want to make more money, are not likely to want to take a duvet day. They want to go into work.
But they won't want to go into work so much. I wouldn't if I knew the office was empty on a Friday.
Right.
So they've got to mandate it.
I'm an introvert, so personally I would love to go into an empty office on a Friday.
But people are always asking, why do we have a productivity crisis in this country?
Yeah.
And this is one of the reasons. Again, amongst
because nobody's doing anything.
Under 34.
That's why. Yeah.
One day out of five, they've said that they tend to work less and be less productive on that, you know?
Right.
And in terms of benefits, by the end of the decade, we're going to be spending £25 billion more on sickness benefits. So this affects all of us.
That absolutely does. We'll have much more to say about this, I'm sure, later on. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up after the break, I'll speak to a teen race car driver who's beat all the odds and is on track to be the first female Formula One driver. You won't want to miss it. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. And now, my next guest has had a rather impressive rise in the world of racing, winning several awards and finishing fourth in the prestigious Daniel Ricciardo Series. And the teenage karting champion is only 15, but she's got her eyes on the prize, eventually hoping to secure a seat in the upper echelons of motorsport racing. I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by teenage karting champion Daniela Sutton and her biggest supporter and stepmother, Rachel. Welcome to both of you. Thank you very much for joining us. Great to see you. You're down here in this part of the world because you're from Warrington, up north. I can tell the story, I suppose. I don't know if I should tell the story, how I know you guys. It goes all the way back to my early days when I used to do a show at TalkSport. It was the overnight show. And your dad, who's called Dan, used to ring in. And because of the old way that we used to do phone-in radio, everybody was kind of known with their first name and where they came from. And it was always Dan from Warrington. So I knew him as Dan from Warrington. And he used to ring in every night, practically, and we'd have great conversations. He was driving, I think, for a living in those days.
He probably still does.
Yeah. And he made an awful lot of sense, and, you know, we sort of hit it off. And I've never met him, but I've now suddenly met his daughter because he got in touch with me and said, you know, my daughter's done this incredible thing. She's got herself into race car driving, rally car driving, and she's brilliant. She's got a sponsor, but she's always looking for more sponsors. That's Dan in the picture there. So tell us, first of all, Daniela, how on earth you got into this business that we were in.
So I was 6 years old when my dad took me indoor karting in Manchester, and then it was only a hobby up until about when I was around 11, when I got my Motorsport UK karting licence.
Right.
And then I raced in the Daniel Ricciardo Series, backed by F1 driver Daniel Ricciardo, for a few years. And then last year, I came fourth in the championship out of 32-plus drivers.
Wow.
Which was quite an achievement, as well as in 2022, I was Total Karting Zero UK North Champion, which is a karting series which is electric, backed by ex-F1 engineer Rob Smedley.
Yeah.
So that was quite exciting
Quite exciting. And it's a proper karts, aren't it? This is like when you read about Lewis Hamilton, how he started. He was a karting champion, and that's how you kind of begin. But they're pretty quick, aren't they? How fast do they go?
Around 70 or 80 miles per hour.
Wow. Yeah. Right. That's that. I mean, I take my kids karting occasionally, and I'm not very good at it, and some of them are actually better than I am. But so what made you do it, though? What did you just fancy it? Did you enjoy the speed? What is it?
So I actually played rugby when I was around 9 years old.
Right.
On an all-boys team as well.
Right.
Which is quite rough.
I bet.
I said to my dad, can I go back to karting, please?
Right.
And he just let me go.
So you're getting smashed into every weekend, And so, I mean, are you racing against other girls and boys, or how does it work?
It's mixed at this stage.
Right.
And hopefully F1 will soon be mixed and there will be female Formula One
drivers.
And I aspire to be one of those.
Yes. So. Well, there's no reason why not. I mean, you know, because, I mean, it's quite a physical job driving, isn't it? I mean, it's more demanding, I suppose, than most people would know. But there's no reason why a woman couldn't do it as well as a man. Is there?
Well, we have to work harder, certainly, but just as people have to work to get into the army, We might have to work two times harder.
Right.
But that doesn't mean we can't get up there.
Yes. And so if you're in an average race, is it, what is it, about 50-50 women and boys?
No, I'd say it's more like 70-30, 80-20.
Right. So more boys than girls. Right. And that doesn't bother you?
No, not at all. We all see each other as competitors and racers rather than by our gender.
Yeah. And this weekend you're going down to Brands Hatch, which of course is, you know, the iconic track. What sort of car are you going to be driving?
I'm going to be driving a Fiesta Mark 7 with Pro Alloys Racing, my team, and I actually won the scholarship, the BRSCC Fiesta Junior Scholarship to race in that this year. And without that, that definitely wouldn't be possible. It's such an amazing prize to win.
Right. And how did you win that? And there's some pictures. As we're talking, we're looking at pictures of you. I mean, I'm so proud of you. I don't even know you really, but I just think it's a brilliant thing that you're doing. And so when you're racing around Brands Hatch, how fast are you going? Same?
Probably around 120 at points. Miles per hour.
120?
Miles per hour, yeah.
See, yeah, I mean, I've driven at 120, but it's very frightening. It's very frightening.
You're not meant to.
I know. I know. There's a stretch of road just as you get over the border in Scotland.
They'll be waiting for you now.
They will be now, yeah. It's always very, very quiet. And Rachel, do you find yourself sort of biting your nails when she's racing?
No, I love it. I get so excited. I get really giddy. I'm just like, look at her go, look at her go. It's your dad, isn't it, that gets kind of nervous. Like, oh, my gosh, look at it.
Right.
But, yeah, she's just such full of determination, aren't you? And it's what you've always wanted to do. And then when we got to this year deciding on the next step and realised we couldn't fund the step to cars.
Yes, because I was going to ask, is it expensive to do then?
Yes, yeah. So the scholarship that Danielle has won covers £65,000 worth of prize, which gives the race weekends, the Friday practice, but no damage, no extra test days.
Right.
So if you think of damaging your normal road car,
it's
that plus probably more.
Right.
And then,
is it your car or do you just kind of borrow the car? Or?
We kind of borrow it from the team.
Right. But if you smash it up, obviously that's a problem.
I've signed something, sadly.
Yes. Well, I mean, this is the thing. And have you ever been in a crash, a bad crash?
Not in cars, in karting. There's been a few. There is with all racing, it's bound to happen. We're racing machines at the end of the day.
Right, you are, and they're very quick. Now, you haven't got a driving licence, right?
No, I haven't.
And is that because you're not allowed to have one at your age?
Yes.
That's ridiculous, isn't it?
You do have a racing driver's licence.
Yes.
Well, you're not racing illegal. No, I didn't mean that. But you couldn't actually get in a car and drive it?
No.
Amazing. And, of course, the one thing that people don't know, and they wouldn't know looking at you or listening to you right now, is that you've also got a sort of a problem, a condition that makes it quite painful for you to race. Tell us about that.
So I have juvenile idiopathic arthritis, which is a hidden disability. It's an immune, disorder.
Right.
So I inject myself with an...
We've got some pictures of you, just, I think, being treated.
Oh, yeah, with an immune suppressant medication.
Right.
Every other week, called adalimumab, and it's managed with that. It's not curable. I am in pain at race weekends sometimes, but then we take anti-inflammatories such as naproxen or ibuprofen or paracetamol to help with pain. So I manage it, yes, and I almost find my racing as kind of that thing to keep me going because if I didn't have my racing, I'd don't think I'd be able to push through the pain.
Right.
It's kind of my aim to get better, and it's my goal to get better for.
And does it affect your racing if you are in pain?
I'd say no, not usually, because the adrenaline takes away all the pain. The adrenaline of, as I said, going 120 miles per hour around a racetrack takes away a lot of the pain.
I guess so. Is it frightening? I mean, are you frightened? I mean, it's exhilarating, I guess, but are you sort of frightened of losing control of the car?
No, I wouldn't say I'm frightened.
I don't think you can be frightened, can you?
If you're frightened, then it's probably not.
But I think a lot, I mean, you know, because of course I used to work in TalkSport, I used to talk to a lot of sporting sort of professionals, and they always stood out for me because they were exactly like that. They found whatever the sport was that they did to be something that they found helpful to them. As opposed, you know, they never approached it in fear. You know, footballers would say, you know, my problems were when I came off the pitch, not when I went on them. You know, and so you seem to have that kind of winning mentality, which is what you need, right?
Yeah, hopefully.
And you're also doing GCSEs, I understand.
Yes, I'm in year 10 right now, and I'm doing my GCSEs in the next year.
So How do you fit all that in? And I mean, what do the people at school think of you?
People at school don't actually aren't quite too bothered about my racing.
It's a pretty unusual thing to be doing at 15, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose, but I think a lot of them don't understand like quite what it is. So when you try and explain it to them, they don't quite believe it sometimes.
Right.
As well, but to balance my education and my racing as well, when I'm not in school because of my racing, I do my work at home. Right. I ask the teachers for work. I ask my school for the work, and we always let the school know. And the school are quite proud of what I'm doing.
Yeah, they should be.
I got a head teacher's award for doing my racing outside as well.
Right. And you talk about wanting to be in Formula One. I mean, who do you like currently in Formula One? Who's you're going to probably be sharing? So I saw an interview with you, and you were sharing sort of pit lane with people from Formula One who had been to that very same place.
Yeah, so I think all the Formula One drivers now, every single Formula One driver is inspirational in their own ways. They all have different driving techniques. They all have different personalities. Obviously, Daniel Ricciardo has to be one of my idols almost because I raced in his karting series, as well as drivers, past drivers such as Michael Schumacher and Ayrton Senna, who are honestly inspirational in many ways.
There he is. Yeah, have you seen the movie Senna? It's absolutely incredible.
Yes,
such a good film.
Very emotional.
Yeah, it really is, and it's a real tribute, I think, to Rachel and to your dad Dan, that they've let you sort of develop this in a way. I mean, I don't want to give them too much credit, but I mean, it must be, you know, nice to have that sort of support as well.
They sacrifice a lot for me, and I'm really grateful for that.
Like, yeah.
They're my number one supporters, and I think they always will be. And my dad actually gets very nervous watching me, which I find quite amusing myself.
Yes. So you're going to go to Brands Hatch probably tonight. You're going to practice tomorrow, presumably?
Yes. So on Friday, it's practice. So I have four practice sessions.
Yeah.
And then on the Saturday, I have quali and race one, qualifying and race one.
Yeah.
And then on Sunday, I have two races.
Okay. And you hope to win them? Do you think you've got a chance of winning them?
Well, always. We're always aiming for top. We're always aiming for P1. If we're not aiming for pole, then...
And do you have sort of rivals that you meet at some of these meetings that you recognise and go, I'm going to beat you today?
I think we all joke about it sometimes, saying, oh, yeah, I'm well quicker than you, or like just joking around.
Right. And you get to blame the car, like Lewis Hamilton does, when he goes, oh, I've got a rubbish car now, that's why I can't win anymore.
Well... I wouldn't say that, no.
Well, I'm not saying you should say that, but I mean, just in case you don't win, you don't want to blame the car.
No, you always criticise yourself because there's always a lot to take out of yourself and improve on, always. You can always find something to improve on.
Of course. Well, it's brilliant to meet you, and good luck on the weekend. What happens after that? And if you are going to make a pathway to Formula One, what's next?
So, obviously, the Fiesta Junior Championship is an amazing series, close-knit racing. Next, I would hope to get scouted possibly for the F1 Academy, which is a series designed for females trying to get the first female Formula One driver.
Okay.
So I suppose that would be the next avenue. And, yeah, it would just be amazing to... race career, really.
I'm going to start following your career now because it's going to be something to watch. It's brilliant to meet you. Thank you so much for coming in. Good luck at the weekend, Danielle and Rachel. And say hi to Dan from Warrington.
I will do.
Who will forever be known as Dan from Warrington.
I know, yeah. I do call him that occasionally. Hey, Dan from Warrington.
What's your point, Dan from Warrington? But brilliant. Really good to see you. Thank you so much.
You.
Very good
Thank
luck with it all. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up next, the food fallout, floods and bad weather spell a shortage for the summer, and a dodgy summer sets to make matters worse. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to The Independent Republic of Mike Graham, right here on Talk TV. Now, it's time for Taking the Mic. It has variously been described as our proudest achievement, the jewel in our nation's crown, the envy of the world, and, if you believe Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, the one thing that makes most of us proud to be British. I'm talking, of course, about the NHS. But in 2024, Even the Labour Party, which still speaks about our health service as if it were some kind of national religion, has started to criticise the way it's run and why it needs to be reformed. Ever since COVID, the NHS has been on its knees. Only this week, we learned that at least one third of the workforce is off sick on any given week. It's been hobbled by strikes for the best part of the last year, but they've hardly made any difference to the efficiency and inefficiency in the system, which is now reaching critical mass. Only a few weeks ago in Bristol, we saw hundreds of people queuing up outside a new dental practice because they had all been unable to access a dentist in the area for years. It's clear that the NHS management have now brought the business to breaking point. Just as we heard that, 7.5 million people are now waiting for hospital treatment, and that's 300,000 more than this time last year. It's not going to get better anytime soon. Even Health Secretary Victoria Atkins admitted that people are waiting in pain and anguish. We absolutely understand that, she said. And these are mostly routine operations like hip replacements, hernia repairs, and diagnostic scans like x-rays. Of course, the first stop to getting any of that kind of treatment is the GP surgery. Again this month, we learned that some GPs are making an absolute fortune. Average salary is now close to £120,000 a year. And yet, people can't get appointments. In Broccoli, in South London yesterday, dozens of people formed a queue outside a doctor's surgery in the hopes of getting to see, you guessed it, an actual doctor. They got there at the crack of dawn, complaining that telephone appointments were impossible to get as the line was constantly engaged. Anna Maria Callahan, one of the hopefuls, said, I've got three appointments to make for me, my child and my elderly mum. Issues that should have been seen weeks ago that are now much worse than they were. It's an absolute shambles. A shambles indeed. When she got to the front of the queue, she was told there were no more slots that day and she'd have to come back tomorrow. The truth of the matter is, and you won't want to hear this anywhere else, there are millions more people in this country now than there were when the NHS decided how many GPs they would need to look after them. One in 20 people now have to wait a month for an appointment. Can anyone see the connection? Because I can. Moving on now, farmers are warning of a food production crisis as the UK suffers its 11th wettest year since records began in the early 1800s, with Storm Kathleen battering the country with heavy rain and strong winds over the last week. I'm joined now by the president of the Farmers Union, Tom Bradshaw. Tom, very good evening to you. Welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. It's difficult to see the effects of all of this rain sometimes when you live in somewhere like London. You know, you just hope when you go out you've got an umbrella with you. But how bad has it actually been for your farmers?
Well, like you say, it's been really extreme, the rainfall that we've had over the past 6 to 9 months. For many, this started back in the summer when they were trying to harvest crops. But then we had Storm Babette back in mid-October, which really set the tone for the winter to follow. And we've just had flooding event after flooding event. We had Storm Henk in January. And it's just put incessant pressure on businesses over this period in time. And many haven't been able to plant their crops. And the crops that we did plant in the autumn haven't thrived. And many have flooded out. And then now in the spring, we're at lambing time. And unfortunately, the rainfall events are putting huge pressure on those that are lambing outside at the moment. And there is real pressure on those young lambs, and there are higher mortality rates than we would normally see because of the rainfall events that we're having.
Right. And, of course, we're told quite often that that people are finding prices going up everywhere they go, whether it's prices in the supermarket or whether it's prices at the local market that they go to. What sort of pressure is being put on farmers to keep those prices low when they're selling into the sort of supermarket business?
Yeah, well, the volatility that was caused by the Ukrainian situation hasn't gone away. And the 2023 harvest was one of the most expensive we've ever grown. And yet the commodity markets have fallen away. But if you look at our milk sector or our horticultural sector, it's been incredibly challenging to pass these cost increases up the supply chain. And it's putting huge pressure on farming businesses to be able to continue to make a viable living. And so then we've had this weather. And potato farmers, they're late planting the crop now. They had a very difficult harvesting period. And many, the confidence has been absolutely shattered. And they're now looking at it and thinking, what do I do going forward? You know, can I afford to invest in my business? Can I afford to continue producing the food that I am so proud to produce?
I mean, we've seen a lot of restaurants closing down, seen a lot of hospitality businesses not being able to sort of make ends meet any longer. Do you think that's going to be what we'll be seeing in the farming sort of region as well?
Yeah, according to the DEFRA statistics, there's about 5,000 less farmers in business now than there was 5 years ago. And the pressures are greater than we've ever seen. And I think the real crux of this is that farmers and primary food producers are carrying all of the risk for the whole supply chain. And we really need to look at how we can share that risk through the supply chain. That's about long-term partnerships so that there really is a shared interest, a shared endeavor to make sure that we continue producing the country's food. We've got 70 million people here living on an island, and that's a wonderful opportunity for British agriculture. But we've got to make sure that we're not undercut by lower standard imports that make it impossible to get the returns from the market that we need to reinvest in the country's food production for the future.
Right. And I understand there's a government flooding recovery fund for those farmers who are, unfortunately, you know, affected by these floods. But it's not working as well as it should, I'm told.
No, look, the headline is a farm recovery fund is very, very welcome. And clearly, we've been waiting to see the details since January. Unfortunately, when it was rolled out earlier this week, the farms that we expected to be eligible just simply were not included within the criteria that would make them eligible for the funding. So there have been changes announced tonight. We're still working through those changes to see how that helps the eligibility. They've removed one critical criteria, which was a limit of only 150 metres from a named watercourse. And so that will make sure that there are more members and more farmers across the country that are eligible, but there will still be many that are missing out. And we'll continue to look at the detail of this to see what further changes need to be made to make sure that those that have borne the brunt of this are able to recover some of their lost income and some of the costs that they're going to have to get their farms back to where they were previously.
Right. And we saw some farmers in Westminster, didn't we, a few weeks back, who were sort of demonstrating against the government about all manner of things. We've seen it in Europe, we've seen it in the Netherlands, we've seen it in France as well. A lot of farmers upset at some of the targets that are being set, some of the net zero stuff that's happening around that. What's the position with many farmers and why were they so angry they had to go to Westminster?
But the pressure on farming businesses, we've had huge volatility, we've had a lot of inflation. Fairness in the supply chain is something that many don't believe is there. And we have a huge amount of risk in producing the country's food, and they just don't believe that there is that shared endeavor with the supply chain. Mm. And then there's imports coming in that are produced using techniques and technologies which are illegal to use here. And that is, you know, we are not on a level playing field. And the NFU has always stood for fair trade, and fair trade and free trade are not the same thing. And at the moment, we are bringing in imports that we would not be able to produce in this country, whether that be Italian eggs that are coming in with a warning from the Food Standards Agency to make sure they're cooked properly, because they cannot be guaranteed salmonella free. Whereas our eggs produced here, you know, they've got the Lion Code on them. It means they are guaranteed salmonella free. And there's many instances like that where there's crop protection products being used, which we don't have access to here. And farmers are really feeling under the cosh. So they've got a lot of things against them at the moment. I do believe that the administration in DEFRA is doing everything they can to work with us, but they really need to start demonstrating that they have a plan for food production in this country, and that they recognize just how serious these weather events of the last 9 months have been, and really look to put the support in place, which means our members have the confidence to invest in their businesses for the future.
Sure. Great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Tom Bradshaw, the president of the National Farmers Union. We'll be keeping an eye on the markets to see exactly what prices go up, what prices go down. But shortages sometimes, but we seem to get through it. Tom, thanks very much indeed. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. We go global in the next hour, looking at the fears of an Iran attack and from Kinsey Schofield on the death of O.J. Simpson. See you then.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Good evening and welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. You're with Talk, we're on TV, we're on radio, online, and of course we're on your smart speaker as well. Coming up, O.J. Simpson has died at the age of 76. The American football star who was acquitted of murder passed away after a battle with cancer. Plus, an attack is imminent. President Joe Biden has promised Israel ironclad support amid fears that Tehran could launch reprisals for an attack that killed senior Iranians. Oh, and the Ginger Whinger and Princess Pinocchio are to release two non-fiction series on Netflix, including cooking and gardening. Is there anything they won't do? Wasn't it just the other day that we were telling you in the Independent Republic about the ludicrously high number of fat cat salaries that were now being paid out in our cash-strapped councils up and down the land? Did we not warn you that increased council taxes and decreased services would be the order of the day for this year, 2024? Well, I'm sorry to say I told you so. You know how I hate doing that. But I told you so. And it's happening already. Faced with bankruptcy, ballooning debt, and the increased cost of paying themselves a literal fortune, our town halls are doing what they do best, aside from overpaying themselves, of course. You guessed it, they're slashing services. And this time, it is in a particularly cruel and nasty way. They're not getting rid of diversity officers or climate change coordinators. They're not losing traffic wardens or recycling officers. No, no, that would be too obvious and un-PC. No, they've decided to kill off some flower beds at war memorials and gardens of remembrance to save a few quid off their landscaping budgets. Absolutely despicable. Everyone knows why they're doing it. More shame about our military past and because they know it's the easiest target. Labour-led East Lothian Council has torn out flower beds surrounding a First World War memorial in Kirkenzie and replaced them with grass turf. Opposition councillors are blaming the SNP for refusing to part with sufficient funds. Presumably they're too busy reporting each other for hate crime every 5 minutes. But it's not just in Scotland this is happening. Rother District Council has grassed over flower beds in Bexhill Cemetery to save money, despite a local petition with hundreds of signatures on it. And the same thing is happening at Royal Sutton Coalfield, where planters and flower beds around two war memorials have been cancelled due to Birmingham City Council's bankruptcy problems. Joanna Marchong of the Taxpayers Alliance said, "Residents are fed up with mean-spirited cuts taking away the small joys in life. Whilst councils undoubtedly need to cut back on spending, they should consider whether there are other areas with fat to trim." Tragically, it is becoming clear that the wokists have already taken captive most of the public services in this country. And isn't it pathetic that they can't find anywhere else to save money, aside from to punish those who fought and died for this country's freedom? It is utterly shameful. Now, later on in the show, we'll be bringing you a first look at tomorrow's front pages. But before anyone else, we've got an exclusive look at the Metro newspaper. And they go with J.K. Rowling, whose headline says, "J.K. Rowling and the Goblet of Ire," which is not bad. I see what they did there. Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling has declared she could never forgive stars of her wizarding movies who cheered on transgendering children after a landmark NHS report criticised weak evidence that it worked and said young people had been let down. This story is going to run and run. She's basically saying she's got no forgiveness for the likes of Daniel Radcliffe, Emma Watson and Rupert Grint, all made very, very wealthy and very, very famous by her own hand. And they seem to be entirely ungrateful for that particular situation. We'll talk more about that when we get the panel back in. But let's talk about US President Joe Biden. He's promised Israel ironclad support amid fears that Iran could retaliate over a strike on its embassy in Damascus last week. Iran's supreme leader says the attack, which killed several senior Iranian commanders, was equivalent to an attack on Iranian territory and that Israel must be punished. Israel has not claimed responsibility, but is widely considered to have been behind the strike. And it's being reported that intelligence services in the United States and other allied officials believe a significant attack by Iran is imminent and could come in the form of a direct missile or through a proxy like Hezbollah in Lebanon. Let's bring in now international security expert Will Geddes and former British Army commander Colonel Richard Kemp. Richard, let me come to you first, if I may, just because you're obviously the man in that sort of region. You're in that region quite a lot. What's being said in Israel about this imminent attack. Do they believe it to be imminent? Do they believe that it will come from Lebanon? What are they saying?
I'm actually in Israel now, and there's a great deal of apprehension on the streets of the various cities of Israel about the possibility of an attack, because if there is an attack by Iran, either from Iran itself or from Lebanon, it could be more devastating than the huge number of rocket attacks they've seen against Israel so far in this war. But either way, there could well be an assault from Iran directly using ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, drones, and the same from its proxy Hezbollah in Lebanon. I think I would suggest if one of those two attacks does happen, and of course that's far from certain, then the more likely possibility would be from Lebanon, because I think Iran deeply fears the retaliation it would get onto its own soil, which could help undermine the stability of the region. I think that's perhaps the more likely of the two, but also, of course, Iran, through its proxies using the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, could also target embassies around the world, blowing up embassies as they have done in the past, Israeli embassies. But of course, Israel, their embassies are well protected. They will be on guard against that, as they are here. The Israeli Defense Force has a very capable missile defense system. They've called up reservists in the last few days to man an additional series of air defense systems. And the US also, I believe, has offered and will make available its own missile defense systems in the region if that is necessary. So I think it's a possibility. It's by no means certain. Israel's ready to deal with it if it occurs, and of course to retaliate if that happens, which is another certainty. Mm.
Absolutely. Will, let me come to you, because you obviously cover international security in many different places. And interesting there what Colonel Richard Kemp was saying, that, you know, there are so many targets now in the world, aren't there? Because, you know, they might decide, well, you know, how about the Israeli embassy in London? How about the Israeli embassy in Paris? How about the Israeli embassy in another part of the world? You know, and the tentacles of Iran have reached this country before, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. And I mean, I agree entirely with what Richard has been saying in terms of how Iran is not going to be, I would have thought, so overt in terms of any kind of retaliation. They have a long history of operating on a very covert level. However, Israeli embassies around the world are incredibly well protected, probably more so than almost any other nation embassies than the United States, I'd say. So I think Iran would be more likely to use its proxies like Hezbollah. Hamas have been rendered to a certain degree inert, although they're obviously a fairly resilient opponent. But it's going to be Hezbollah and other elements that Iran has proxy financed and backed. Iran will never really break cover themselves. If they do, they know they're going to get the wrath of the United States. And I'm only pleased that, although it's very much down the line, that Biden has stepped forward and made such a bold statement in terms of his support for Israel.
Yes, exactly. And Richard, let me ask you about that, because obviously until that moment, until Joe Biden came out and said that there would be a steadfast kind of defence of Israel and its right to retaliate or do whatever if Iran was to make a strike, you know, things were looking a bit iffy between the White House and Jerusalem up until that moment, because we'd heard, of course, the calls for a ceasefire. We'd heard Cameron as well echoing sort of Joe Biden's calls that, you know, our support for Israel is not unconditional and all of that. Has this kind of given a bit more succor, if you like, to the Israeli government in terms of what they're doing?
Well, I think so, but it's, I think Biden's stance is still quite iffy. Of course, so far he's been pretty strong, pretty resilient in the support he and force have given to and intelligence services have given to Israel since this war began, quite rightly, as has Britain, of course. But he has been very critical in recent weeks, particularly since the unfortunate accidental killing of 7 aid workers in Gaza. That I think should be seen to an extent as being he's talking to the anti-Israel elements of the US electorate. Obviously, one can't just sort of assume that he's going to be 100% supportive, but I think one ought to bear that in mind. But it's also very dangerous for him to say that sort of even if it is for domestic political purposes, because of course it encourages Hamas to keep fighting. It encourages Iran to threaten Israel and even to attack Israel, to continue using its proxies, because but Biden's words, and as we've seen from David Cameron in the UK and elsewhere, they give the impression that Israel is becoming increasingly isolated and that the international community will pressurize Israel to stop fighting. And if Israel stops fighting, that's about the only chance that Hamas has got for survival, as Will rightly says. Their last leg. They're still fighting. They are resilient, as he said. But these sort of words from the likes of Cameron and Biden and Blinken do give them hope and do encourage them to fight harder and to refuse, for example, the ceasefire terms that have been proposed in exchange for Israeli hostages in Gaza.
Absolutely. Will, back to you. We've seen previously warnings from MI5 and MI6 in this country that there are some Iranian dissidents here who might become targets if things get hotter in the Middle East, if you like. I presume we remain on pretty high alert here. We saw just the other night Champions League football matches were thought to be a target. Lots of people seem to think that there will be some kind of terrorist attack somewhere soon. What are you hearing?
Well, to be honest, I mean, I'm pretty much would concur with what you're saying, Mike. We're at the substantial level, which is kind of mid-range in the threat levels, which means that a threat is likely, not highly likely, which is the next level up. And I would say that we should anticipate, I'm certainly forecasting, that I think we will be raising the threat level in the imminent period. As to exactly when, that will be based, obviously, on intelligence that comes in that will provide us with information as to whether it is a viable threat and there are viable threats that are coming through. But I think the problem that we have is any country that is going to support Israel will have accepted the fact that they will get potentially collateral damage as a result of it. Iran has financed certainly protests, organizations, individuals. They're very insidious in how they operate, Mike. So, you know, the fact is Iran will operate in a very covert capacity. They won't be overt. And, you know, Richard, in terms of his position on the ground, he knows certainly better than me in what the position is there with the Israelis. But I would say everybody's a little bit skeptical about certainly Biden, about Cameron, as to whether, although they're coming up with the political rhetoric, are they going to actually back it up? That's the big question.
Yeah. And finally, Richard, just back to you. We saw that assassination, I suppose, if you want to call it that, of the three sons of one of the Hamas leaders. There were lots of pictures of him looking not particularly, shall we say, bothered by the fact that three of his sons who were fighting for Hamas had been killed by Israeli forces. Do they feel as if they're getting near the end of this in Israel?
Well, I think it's an interesting incident, because what were these three pretty senior and important members of the Hamas terrorist organization, the Sons of Haniyeh, what were they doing above ground, where they were killed? That would suggest to me that a lot of the Hamas infrastructure underground has been destroyed by Israel. Certainly Israel says it has destroyed a lot of it, obviously not all, but a lot of it has been destroyed, which makes them even more vulnerable. So I think there will be a feeling among the Hamas leadership, whether it's Yahya Sinwar in Gaza or Ismail Haniyeh in Qatar in his six-star hotel or whatever he's in there,
right,
there will be a feeling that things are going to go badly soon. And I think the reality is when Israel attacked Rafah, that's Hamas's last bastion. Obviously, it's not the end of Hamas completely, but it will indicate the destruction of Hamas to a very large degree. And that's why it's so important that the world, the US, the UK, other countries, back Israel as much as they possibly can to push on to the end. Let's not forget also that that's what Arab countries want. Most Arab countries in the region want Israel to destroy Hamas, and some of them have been actively helping Israel to do so.
Yes. Well, we can all hope that it comes to an end sooner rather than later. Colonel Richard Kemp, thank you very much indeed. Will, thanks very much indeed to you as well. Will Geddes, the security expert and consultant, talking to us there about the latest situation with Iran. Now, O.J. Simpson, the former American football star who was acquitted of murder, has died at the age of 76 after battling cancer. His family confirmed the news on social media, saying he passed away on Wednesday. He was convicted and then later acquitted of killing his ex-wife and her friend in 1994. Joining me now is historian and broadcaster Rafe Heidel-Mankoo and also Kinsey Schofield, host of the To Die For daily podcast. Kinsey, welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Rafe, welcome back. We'll come on to some royal Harry and Meghan news in a bit, but let's talk a little bit about O.J. Simpson. I think Piers Morgan got it right when he tweeted out that so many people watched the trial of O.J. Simpson, but even more people probably watched the inevitably mad car chase that started before all of that. I mean...
Well, I was at university in North America at the time, and I vividly recall watching it with my friends. I mean, looking back 30 years now, this was such a momentous event in social and cultural history in America, I think, and in many ways... it ushered in some of the modern age. Mm. This was reality TV for the first time.
Yes.
This car chase and the court case really introduced us to reality TV, just like the Gulf War had rolling news for us with CNN.
Yeah.
And also in other ways too. I mean, it really. I remember during the trial, people were saying this is the trial of the century. I said, well, there was something called the Nuremberg Trials.
Yes.
It's Nazi war criminals. Right. Let's put this into perspective. But it was so important in actually revealing to us for the first time properly outside of America the gulf between black America and the rest of America.
Yes.
That 80% of black Americans thought he was innocent compared to the similar number on the other side saying that he wasn't. And you really saw there the divide, not only just on race, but on wealth grounds as well, where you saw somebody who had an extremely well-equipped defence team.
Yeah.
You know, Johnny Cochran and Alan Dershowitz and Bob Shapiro. We've got the Kardashians through that as well.
Yeah, it was also sort of the beginning of the rock star lawyer type, wasn't it?
Exactly. And you saw the injustice in the American system whereby the under-resourced prosecution simply couldn't face that sort of a defence team. And the fact that it was a predominantly black jury that acquitted him only exacerbated the situation, further increased when it was a predominantly white jury that found him civilly liable for about £30 million pounds or so. And this all happened 2 years after the Rodney King attacks, the riots in America in Los Angeles, when there was the first viral clip, really, of the modern age.
Yes.
When American police were beating up a black man. And taken together, those two things, I think, really gave us a glimpse of the world we live in today, of the culture wars and the racial division and so forth.
You could absolutely say that that's, in a way, when it started. Kinsey, let me come to you, because you may not remember the car chase, and you're probably not very old when that actually happened. I think I was in America at the same time, and I remember switching on the TV and just gasping kind of at the awe of what I was seeing. You know, helicopters up in the air, you know, following this car that was being chased by a load of police down a highway, thinking to myself, where on earth does he think he's going? He's on national television.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, an estimated 150 million people did watch the verdict of the O.J. Simpson trial, but it was 95 million people that watched that car chase. And it's changed the way Los Angeles local news works today. If I'm scheduled to be on local news, they'll say, we'll see you at 5 p.m. unless there's a car chase. Because with little to no detail, the city of Los Angeles stops and covers a car chase based on this.
Right.
And there's actually a rumor, too, that David Hasselhoff has beef with O.J. Simpson because it was supposed to be his big American pay-per-view debut.
Right.
And he was going to launch his American music career because he'd been so successful in Europe the same night that this happened. And unfortunately, no one tuned in for David Hasselhoff. Kate Hudson recently talked about how her stepfather is seen in the back. Kurt Russell is seen in the background of footage at O.J. Simpson's house after he pulled up because they lived down the street. And even a Hollywood star like Kurt Russell just was so curious and wanted to be in the mix.
And is it still the case that the world, or certainly the world in America, is split down the middle as to whether he killed his wife or not?
No. Mark Lamont Hill, who is a pretty liberal commentator, said today that O.J. Simpson killed two people, but he was acquitted because it was the right thing to do because of it fixed some racial inequality here in the States. So I think that everybody here pretty much agrees that O.J. Simpson killed two individuals. And it was this shameless way that he went about the rest of his life that I think, you know, convinced a lot of people, whether it was his juiced reality television show, whether it was his hypothetical book, If I Did It. I mean, I think everybody pretty much agrees today that the man did it.
Yes. Well, extraordinary. Rafe, what do you make of that?
In white America, they do. But what's telling is that even 30 years later, just about 52% of black Americans now think he did it.
Right.
So still, I mean, because you have to understand that the tribalism that was there. Yeah. It almost made me think about, you know, last week we had a poll about only one quarter of UK Muslims believe that Hamas committed rape and murder in Israel.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of tribalism where people don't want to lose face with their own community. And also, and you just think, you know, for black Americans, it was such a big blow because he was one of the few black icons who crossed the race barrier.
Yeah.
And you think about who were the last three to do that? Bill Cosby, Michael Jackson, and O.J. Simpson, all for three different reasons, you know, had their comeuppance in their own way. But you can understand why there was so much investment in this man and why that community still to this day has difficulty accepting it.
Yeah. And Kinsey, will it be an awkward sort of time again for America as people see that O.J. has died? They're talking about, obviously, everything once again. It was a particularly brutal murder. You know, nobody really remembers much of his football career anymore, and even his movie career was pretty sort of long and distant time away, and it wasn't exactly star-studded. I mean, he was in Towering Inferno, and he was in some, you know, quite bad films. He wasn't really a great actor. But I mean, it'll be difficult to imagine him having a sort of star-studded funeral, for example.
Well, the Pro Football Hall of Fame, they did tweet something only acknowledging the highlights of that 11 years in the NFL. But there's, you know, Fred Goldman came out today and said, I'm going to take the day to remember my son, Ronald Goldman, who didn't have the privilege of living as long as O.J. Simpson did. Caitlyn Jenner posting good riddance. I think for the most part, it's going to be hard to find anybody that relives his glory days. We're all going to be pretty fixated on the more salacious parts of his life.
Yes, I think so. Let's move on to our favourite couple, Harry and Meghan. They're in the news once more. We've got breaking news here today that Duchess of Sussex and Prince Harry will launch two non-fiction series on Netflix featuring cooking, gardening, and wait for it, my favourite of all, professional polo.
Well, cooking, gardening, and friendship is the description of Meghan Markle's show specifically. I thought you were saying, wait for it, friendship, because that was the big kicker for me. I want to stress that it was yesterday that Prince William acknowledged Rachel Day on social media, and the tone there was Prince William breaks his silence after the Princess of Wales's cancer diagnosis. I want to tell you, I believe that was to the Sussexes team permission to send their PR into high gear post Kate's cancer reveal, because this is a PR push for Meghan Markle. When you share the article on Deadline, the headline is Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, launching two Netflix shows, no mention of Harry. If you look at Deadline's Facebook page, no mention of Harry in the description. Comments 90% negative, by the way. I think people really dislike Meghan Markle, and it must absolutely destroy her, or we wouldn't see her fighting so hard to be relevant. But I believe that this is a real PR push for Meghan Markle, even in the description of these shows, cooking, gardening, entertaining, and friendship. Give me a barf bag.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, Rafe, do you need any help with friendship advice?
Well, I was just thinking,
polo.
It's a shame Harry's not going to be involved. They could do a reenactment of the Fanny Craddock cookery series, you know, just have him half sozzled in the background there.
That's right.
Maybe doing some of his own herbs in the gardens.
Well, look, there's Harry doing some juggling outside. Absolutely right. I mean, this is coming just after they launched, or she relaunched her new website, right? The sort of the cookery what was it called? American Riviera, something or other.
With her new lifestyle brand. But, you know, we've seen a pulling back of that because, of course, probably didn't seem to be the most tasteful thing to do. Well, with the cancer diagnosis of the King and the Princess of Wales, didn't seem like the right time for them to launch that. But obviously, now apparently it is the right time for her to do that. But, of course, the problem now, of course, is that Prince Harry is left rudderless because she's actually very good at lifestyle branding. She had Tig and everything else. She's got exactly what she wanted to get out of her relationship with Prince Harry. She's now a star. She can do what she wants to do.
Yeah.
But he's left still. He's got no discernible skills.
No.
He's got no commercial abilities.
No.
He's left without any real role. That's why you're seeing him say, well, I wouldn't mind coming back and helping out in the hour of need, the royal family, because the only thing he knows how to do is be a royal. That's sort of why they've created this mini American court in the US. princess. Their website looks more regal. Mm. They're calling their children prince and princess. Mm. And they've got these charitable endeavours where he can go and cut some ribbons and read some pre-written speeches because that's really all that he knows how to do.
Absolutely. And Kinsey, do you think that at the Shea Montecito, they've been keenly watching Scoop, that new Netflix drama about, Uncle Andrew and when he was questioned by Newsnight?
I mean, I always love to remind people that this is Prince Harry's employer. This is Meghan Markle's employer, reminding the world of one of the current royal family's lowest moments here with Scoop, with the last few seasons of The Crown. Prince Harry is cashing checks from these people that do not hesitate to, stab the royal family in the back time after time with some of the content they're creating. But for the record, I thought this was a pretty good movie and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed every second of it.
I mean, I must say, as a journalist, you don't often watch things which are about journalism and say, actually, that was pretty well done. But I think it was pretty well done. And finally, what about the old the visa problem and, the spare confessions that he took a load of drugs, Prince Harry, and he may have lied about that, either in the book or on his visa application. How's that all going?
So right at this point in time, a federal judge here in the United States has Prince Harry's visa information sitting on his desk. I mean, he knows by this point whether or not Prince Harry was given special privileges or whether Prince Harry lied in his visa application. I don't know. I think if he did lie, I think that that's very newsworthy. And I think that that's information that the American public would like to have. So perhaps the judge would make that public. I'm not necessarily sure. But Prince Harry seen, I believe it was yesterday in San Francisco with Mindy Kaling at a Better Up event, talking to people about how to deal with corporate stress. Like, that's something he's ever had to experience in his life. But I think you're both absolutely right. Prince Harry is kind of left at a loss, and Meghan Markle it gets to be the princess of America.
Yeah, extraordinary stuff. Kinsey, great to see you as ever. Thank you very much indeed, Kinsey Schofield there. Ray, final word from you. We're going to have yet another sort of 6 months of fun and games, by the looks of it, from the House of Montecito, aren't we?
I know, nothing is over yet. And, of course, we've got also the arrival next month on May the 8th, VE Day, 10th anniversary of Invictus, where Harry will be coming over to St Paul's Cathedral. And we expect, obviously there'll be a meeting with his father. And there's talk about his father trying to perhaps broker peace with the two brothers. I think that's for the birds. I think we're a long way from sort of a reconciliation along those lines. But anyway, very pleased to see Prince Andrew. Was delighted to see to watch Scoop. I was told that he didn't even break a sweat watching it.
But I'm sure that's true.
It's not a 5-star review that I think Netflix were expecting to get. But he seems to be quite happy about the way he was portrayed in that, which is quite interesting.
It is, because he's portrayed as a rather boorish character who doesn't have very much to say for himself. But there we are. Rafe, good to see you again. Thank you very much indeed, Rafe Adelman-Koo there. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Gray. My delightful panel are back after the break with the rest of today's news, some updates from Julian Assange's case as well, plus some nonsensical fake Chinese stamps. Do not go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham in one of the longest running news stories of all time. Julian Assange is back in the headlines after the first bit of progress since his extradition fears dating back to 2012. The Australian government has revealed that after all this time and so much effort wasted, the US federal government is considering dropping criminal charges against the WikiLeaks founder and that Mr. Assange may be able to leave Belmarsh prison and return home to his native Australia. Australia even. With me right now, the panel. They're back. Now, that was them all trying to salute at the same time, which clearly didn't work very well.
They got jealous.
I mean, this is the thing, right? You give one of them a salute,
yes,
and then they all want it. Sam Dowler's here, Reem Ibrahim as well, Andrew Eborn. Welcome back. I mean, wouldn't it be pathetic? And it would be sort of typical ending of this Julian Assange farce.
Yes.
For it all just to be now forgotten, to sort of fall limply over the edge of a cliff. And you go, oh, well, off you go. Back. They've dropped a charge in Sweden. They don't want him in America anymore. Just go back to Australia.
Look, at the end of the day, I saw a movie the other day about the whistleblower in America who came out and said about how the Russians had got involved in the Trump. It was a movie, Reality Man.
And so
I think whistleblowing is a really important thing, especially if you're in a scenario. So hasn't he been punished enough, is what I think. His life has pretty much been ruined.
Different. As always, got to put it in perspective. It's 2010 happened. Well, all the way back to that.
It's like he's been in prison since then.
And he's been in parts of embassies and so on and so forth. It's been a horrible time, and people are coming out about sort of and that sort of stuff. But enough already. You need to turn around. But also, there's got to be a balance, because we need to depend on whistleblowers when terrible things happen.
And he exposed corruption. Let's be honest about this. With regard to the way in which the WikiLeaks scandal occurred, he exposed corruption, and we shouldn't be punishing people that expose the truth.
Mm. I suppose not, but I mean, the argument from the American government side was that he did put quite a few people's lives in danger at the time. And I mean, what he did, he didn't do particularly, I would say, discriminately. You know, he just dumped a whole bunch of thousands and thousands of documents. And actually, in some ways, maybe that was good, because very few people could be bothered to go through them all. Yeah. You know, but there were people whose lives were certainly put in danger and possibly were even killed.
You have to put that into balance.
They'd have to make that case.
But you also have to imagine the mindset of someone who was there. You're in a scenario, you're in a massive conglomerate where you're so terrified and you think that something is wrong. It's so wrong that you're prepared
to go
to such lengths. And he ended up being right. Yeah, exactly.
But it's also important that you do have somebody who can hold the feet of those in the power to the fire. What he exposed with the US airstrikes in Baghdad, there were diplomatic cables and classified communication from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. But you're right, Mike, is there was too much. Mm. And some of the people's lives were put at risk.
Yes.
And I think whilst whistleblowing is absolutely right, where there's corruption and wrongdoing, other things you need to be a bit more selective. And it was
just a dump. If governments weren't inherently corrupt, then we wouldn't need whistleblowers. And that's the point. Yeah. The fact of the matter is, I blame the US government for putting those people at risk in the first place.
Yeah, well, maybe.
Let's say we had a whistleblower from Putin's regime, for example.
Yes.
Of course he would be on death's door instantly. I mean, he would move to America or whatever. Right. But, like, this is the thing. Like, you know, Assange is not at death's door. He's not going to be murdered. Because it's fine. If he was murdered now, it would be ridiculous.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because we are in a Western democracy,
but also it was the right thing to do, but also
a crime.
And also, let's not forget, an awful lot of the delay in his kind of processing was partly down to him.
Yes.
He went and sought sort of the solace of the Ecuadorian
embassy. Pamela Anderson.
And Pamela Anderson. And the strangest twist of all, really.
That's a win for any straight man, surely.
I used to say to the producers here, I said, the only reason I would ever do the Julian Assange story is if you get me Pamela Anderson.
Oh, there you go.
I don't care otherwise.
Absolutely. But it was Chelsea Manning. He got all the information from Chelsea Manning as well. And Chelsea Manning, remember, it was 2017, was released and pardoned by President Obama, because originally Chelsea was sentenced to 35 years in prison.
Yeah.
Mm. And looking at that sort of...
They don't mess around in the US.
No, it's
huge. I think he's worried as well. He's going to try and get a pardon from Biden before Trump gets in.
But Trump already said, I am WikiLeaks. He said that in one of his speeches. Obviously, because he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Truth Social. He was like,
I am WikiLeaks. That's why he said I am Mr. Brexit as well.
And Trump is also quite possibly one of the most corrupt politicians.
Yeah, exactly.
Trump is a lovely man. He speaks so highly of you. Who do you look like? He looks very good.
I know what he's doing now.
And that's an outrage for you to say that. And she's absolutely correct. He is, of course, one of the most corrupt politicians in the whole...
Well, you say that. But, you know, he hasn't been found guilty of anything corrupt. But
91 indictments, however.
And you know what an indictment is, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not actually a conviction. Yeah.
So no.
And you have to absolutely say that for legal reasons and other bits of business.
Let's talk about smoking.
You want to talk about smoking?
I did.
Boris says that Rishi Sunak has gone mad. Is he right?
He's absolutely right. It's the one good thing that Boris Johnson has done since he disgracefully left Number 10. I think that the smoking ban is absolutely absurd. So, effectively, the government have put into Parliament the Tobacco and Vapes Bill, where the government are basically saying for 1 year every year, the smoking age is going to increase.
Yeah.
So that means it's a 14-year-old today will never be able to legally buy tobacco products. Now, I think, from my perspective, we've got to look at this within the wider society. The government has two choices. Either tobacco is provided by a taxed and regulated private sector, or it is provided by criminal gangs. There is no third option in which it's provided by nobody. Mm. And we've seen it in countries like South Africa and in Bhutan, where this does just fuel criminal activity.
Right.
And the reason why I think it's so important is A, if you want to smoke, smoke. It's your right to do so. Do what you want with your own body. We all know it's bad for us.
Well, everybody's smoking dope everywhere you go. I mean, you can't get away from the smell of it.
No, you
but
cannot.
Apparently that's okay.
No, you're absolutely right. Exactly. You cannot, I've noticed this recently. You cannot escape it. You cannot escape the smell of weed. And no, I don't.
And it's illegal.
And I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with it. But, however, like...
But it is meant to be illegal.
Yeah, exactly. It's meant to be illegal. But if, for example, everybody stops smoking tomorrow, the UK economy would collapse, obviously, because of the amount of tax. Like, yeah. If you go and try and buy a packet of, like, 30 grams of Pall Mall, it's 22 people.
Smoking rates have declined in this country.
Of course.
Not by banning smoking, but by people switching to safer, healthier products like vaping.
Yeah.
Vaping is more than 95% less harmful. We saw that from Cancer Research UK, Public Health England, various different studies.
Well, it depends on that. So some of those vapes are actually, they're exploding people's faces. They're causing all sorts of damage.
Yeah, but that's a rare
illegal.
Thing.
What was interesting...
Imagine what are the chances of you riding an electric bike while vaping?
That's a bomb on wheels.
Now, listen, that's enough about vaping. Let's talk about the Chinese flooding the UK with fake stuff.
Are awful, isn't it? But there are ways to spot them.
Well, I don't know. How do you tell they're fake?
You can tell they're fake. The perforations are not right.
Right.
Seriously right. If you have a look at it, the colouring is not quite right.
Where do you
on
get
the
them anyway, though?
What happens, and some of the posters have been supplied by people online with these stamps.
Why are the post office buying stamps
online?
Well, no,
because it's the little local post office person. They talk about that sort of stuff.
They lock them all up.
It's really not the time for the post office to have more bad press. Do you know what I mean?
And also,
shock horror, the Chinese are flooding the market with fake... Have you ever been to Temu or Shein? Yeah. It's fake everything.
The trouble is this. People are having to pay £5 to have their letters delivered now because people are using these fake stamps. In good faith. They probably bought them online.
I'm sorry, but you've got to be a bit thick.
Yeah, you shouldn't be buying stamps online.
You're right.
You're running a post office.
So that's the warning.
Sorry, this is Royal Mail we're talking about.
Don't buy the stamps online. That's the warning.
That's exactly right.
But honestly, the Royal Mail don't know their stamps from their elbows, to be fair.
I mean, I don't ever send anything by post.
I mean, who
post.
Does by stamps?
But also, who sends letters anymore?
Snail mail.
Carrier pigeons that you could use.
I'll tell you who does, though, because I found this is an insidious development. If you get a parking fine, from any of the councils in London.
The
only way you can appeal it is by sending a letter.
Yeah.
You can't appeal it online.
I'll have to contest you there because I
do get quite a few parking fines. I've discussed it on your show before.
Have you ever appealed them?
I've appealed every single one of them. I've got maybe half.
But you have to write a letter though, don't you?
Yeah, but you have, or you can say it online, but then they will send you another letter. They will do it by mail.
What I love is that if you sent them a letter using one of the Moody stamps, they have to pay a fiver to receive it. So there'll be glorious justice on that set of bases.
Now, you guys might not know about this story, but I've got to mention it to you. The Royal Navy has got some new policy.
Oh, I love that. You don't need to swim.
You don't need to be able to swim.
I said, and you can join the fire brigade if you're scared of heights, and you can become a doctor, a surgeon if you faint when you see the sight of blood. All of these things are new, and it's a great policy.
You should be allowed to do any kind of military service if you
can't. If you can't swim.
I mean, there used to be a 30-minute swim test.
Yes.
Day. Now, swimming for half an hour is quite good. It's quite hard to do, I'd imagine. But, I mean, if you're on a boat and you're in the Royal Navy...
Yes.
And the boat sinks and you can't swim.
Yeah.
But you're a liability.
Well,
aren't you
putting everybody else in danger?
We can laugh about it, but isn't it really, really upsetting that these are the people that are supposed to be defending our country?
Yeah.
I have to say that the story does say that they did abolish that. However, you would get into phase one and then they would teach you to swim in that phase, and then you would move forward.
They're really worried about recruitment. So what they're saying is we're going to let more people in.
Yeah.
We're going to get more people in, but they have to be able to swim before they qualify. They only get to phase one, and what the objection
says
is
weak
it's costing
no
money.
Longer need to take lessons in their own time
before they apply.
You get it at work. They'll teach you how to swim.
But there's only before they
what
apply.
What are your responsibilities at phase one? Are you actually?
No, you then get trained. So the complaint is it's going to cost lots of money to train them to swim. So basically, you're getting the non-swimmers later. That's how you
determine. There can't be that many. It's not going to be a drain on, you know, society.
I mean, also, we have only got about two ships.
I've
worked out what the problem is here. Guess who's in charge of the Navy? Grant Shapps.
My local MP.
Who sent
us a little leaflet.
He
sent us a leaflet through the post the other day saying that even though he is Minister for Defence, he still cares about us. I sent him an email saying about the potholes and he did not reply.
And he again used the Moody stamp, so you had to pay a fiver for that as well. So you work on that basis.
Now, it says here there's a film based on the classic board game Monopoly. It's preparing to pass go. Margot Robbie's production. How can you make a film about Monopoly?
Very simple. And she's going to have the plot. So I was in Cannes, did I tell you that?
Yeah,
tell us again.
We were talking about basically expanding.
Never mind about all that. Did you go to any good parties?
I had loads of parties. I was with Rick Astley last night.
Were you staying in a tent on the beach with a refugee?
I wasn't. But Margot Robbie, expanding the brand, that's what it's all about. So they did Barbie, about $1 billion, fantastic stuff. Her production company is now doing the rights to Monopoly.
I'm absolutely in love with Margot Robbie.
Right, I think Margot
Robbie. She speaks very highly of you.
She's the most beautiful woman.
She is incredible, yeah. However, the problem for me is that Barbie you can make something of because you know there's Ken, there's Barbie, make a silly film. Yes. How can you make something with Mr.
Oh, very simple. No, you've got glorious characters.
It's financial peril. You know, they've got to have, you know, the top hat guy.
Margot Robbie is going to do what she did for feminism for capitalism and I'm all here for it.
Well, I look forward to it, but it doesn't sound good to me.
I hope it's pro-capitalist. I hope it's pro-trade, pro-business.
Hasbro, who are licensing the rights, they say it actually lends itself more to a story because you've got so many different characters involved.
Well, it could be like a Wall Street.
It's all about teaching people about property.
Question for you. Do you know what the original Monopoly board actually was?
Tell us.
Come on, Andrew.
I reckon it's probably about 1910.
But what was it actually of? Which city?
I don't know. It wasn't London, was it?
Was it New York?
No.
Where was it?
Atlantic City.
Atlantic City?
Yes. For some reason, it was Atlantic City. Now, of course, you can get all sorts of different forms of Monopoly, which are actually quite ridiculous. You know, like they've got...
There's a RuPaul's Drag Race Monopoly.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. Yeah, I mean, there's a Monopoly you can get without any money, but it's only cash.
Yes.
My hope for this...
Central digital currency Monopoly.
CBDC.
Bitcoin
Monopoly. I really hope that this movie is a pro-capitalist, pro-entrepreneurship game. And, you know,
it won't be.
It's going to be woke. It's Margot Robbie, isn't it? I do love Margot Robbie, but she is a bit of a lefty, wokey feminist.
But it was actually, to your point, it was 120 years ago that it was first marketed. Left-wing American feminist called Lizzie Maggie is what, in 1904 is what it did. And it was originally called the Landlord's Game. There you go. And that's why.
It was actually anti-capitalist.
And the Great Depression is what suddenly made it go into Monopoly.
That's the whole thing, though. When you play Monopoly with your family, I mean, it was always arguments.
The biggest fight.
Because that's the whole thing, but you don't necessarily go to somewhere and then suddenly you're stuck with this massive bill. That's not really like real life, is it?
But it's teaching children about money and how to take care of their money and invest.
It's teaching people how to negotiate, which is good.
My children will be playing Monopoly every time.
Okay, well, that's enough about Monopoly because Hike of the Week returns tomorrow night at 7 p.m. only here on Talk TV. Here's a flavour of what you can expect.
Yeah, I blame the parents. If you're Mr. and Mrs. Rag and you call your son something that is shortened to Willie, he started off badly. So already we need to feel sorry for William Rag, the member to take a quick look at.
Right.
And so he was caught up in a honey trap.
Has he ever done a private member's bill, do you think?
He should keep his members private. That would have solved this problem, wouldn't it? So this honey trap it sounds more romantic than it is, because a honey trap, you imagine some sort of espionage thing. You met someone on Grindr. The other person sent a room.
It's not very romantic, Grindr, I'm told.
I've never checked, but I'll take your word for it. So the other person, this scammer, sent the rude picture. Yeah. But William wasn't dragged up. He realises etiquette dictates that one should reciprocate a DP.
Right.
So he sends one back.
So that's Plank of the Week coming tomorrow. You're watching the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up after the break, we'll look at all the top stories from tomorrow's papers, plus a bit more climate hysteria once again emanating from the United Nations. Where else? Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching The Independent Republican, Mike Graham, right here on Talk TV. Now, it's time for this.
The World of Woke.
Now, how many times have we heard the clarion call? How long have we got to save the planet? Aren't we already in some kind of climate emergency? If you believe the Just Stop Oil doommongers and the Greta Thunbergs of this world, you might be forgiven for thinking it's already too late. But, of course, they keep extending the deadline. Even though we're not doing enough to stop climate change, and even though our net zero commitments aren't being met fast enough, and despite being told that we've missed every ecological deadline there is, apparently there's still time. But wait, there's a new doom and gloom merchant to be heard from. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Simon Steele, a previously unheard-of climate zealot who resides as the Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC for short. That's a new one on me. He's come out and said, we only have 2 years left to save the world, which in its way sounds even more dramatic than Ed Miliband once declaring rather pompously that we only had 24 hours to save the NHS. Of course, that was 10 years ago, back in 2014. Simple Simon, a former minister in Grenada, by contrast, is talking about the here and now. He made a speech at Chatham House in London in which he declared the next 2 years to be pivotal because of record-shattering heat and a race between countries to a new clean energy economy. The title of the speech was 2 years to save the world. Simon was one of the key figures at the COP28 climate summit in Dubai, where the main achievement was to all agree there should be a COP29 in Baku, Azerbaijan, in November this year. Considering the worldwide alarm at all these events, you'd have thought they wouldn't have to keep having them. But there's nothing like a global jolly for all the politicians and green goblins to fly into on private jets once a year, is there? Apparently, it's still all our fault, of course, even though the UK has actually reduced emissions by 52.7% since 1990. Not good enough, say the climate zealots. We are still going to miss our UN goal of a 68% cut by 2030. Simon says we saw record-breaking fires in Canada and Greece last year. No mention of them being started by arsonists, of course. And he reckons we had extreme heat waves baking Europe, North America and China. I thought it was quite nice last summer, actually. Next year, the COP30 party will be held in Brazil. I bet the climate loons can't wait to shake their booties on Copacabana Beach. By then, of course, it would have become too late to save anything. So just try and enjoy the rest of the week.
The World of Woke.
Now, we haven't got a great deal of time left, guys, so we're going to have to look at a couple of the papers. The Sun have got a very interesting front page headline. They've got a picture of O.J. Simpson with a headline that says, good riddance.
Very subtle.
But this is coming from Caitlyn Jenner, because one of the things that we were talking about was that many of you, apart from Andrew, of course, will be too young to remember all this.
Yes.
But I mean, the Kardashians began in the O.J. Simpson. Yeah. And, of course, Kylie Jenner and the whole Jenner family were on the other side of the room because they were sort of on the side because they were friends of his ex-wife who he was accused of killing. So the whole sort of Kardashian Jenner thing was born.
And it was
during O.J. Simpson.
And it also made it incredibly popular. I mean, it meant that the story was completely blasted all over social media. Right. And with people that, generally speaking, wouldn't have been as interested in a double homicide like this or in a murder story like this.
Well, there was no social media back then.
It was wall-to-wall coverage, wasn't it? Wall-to-wall from the car case to the other bits and pieces.
There's a programme called The People versus O.J. Simpson.
Yes.
I've seen it with Cuba Gooding Jr. As O.J.
When he plays him,
and it's excellent. It's so because it just shows you. You're right. It's like, you know, if they had social media at the time, it would have blown up. But it was.
Just putting it in perspective, 1995, he was acquitted of murder, but 2008, he was sentenced to 33 years imprisonment on an unrelated charge.
Clearly, Caitlin
to do with
still
robbery and that robbery, sort of stuff.
Caitlin still clearly holds a grudge.
Absolutely right. Speaking of holding a grudge, J.K. Rowling's holding one. Great headline. It's J.K. Rowling in the Goblet of Ire.
That's hilarious. All credit to... I love a good pun.
I think she's absolutely right, though, because Daniel Radcliffe, Emma Watson and Rupert Grint would be absolutely no one without J.K. Rowling.
I think it's despicable.
That's not specifically true. They are not... She was not the casting director at Warner Brothers.
She
created the characters, but she didn't cast them. So they don't really...
Hang on.
They don't owe her anything.
No, I'm not having that. Without her writing the book, never made
that's,
film.
That's the same as like saying that every actor in Lord of the Rings deserves like their career.
Just one thing, Sam. Is it right that J.K. Rowling, as the creator, is banned from attending some of these Harry Potter
things.
She's
not banned.
No, but they wouldn't let her turn up because of the controversy.
No, she was invited and she decided not to turn up herself.
I think the point of this story is that J.K. Rowling herself has effectively tried to insist that women's rights should trump any sort of notion of different types of feelings or different types of people feel. And her the stars that starred in Harry Potter haven't defended her, haven't supported her. And that's
They've attacked her. So what J.K. said is, don't apologise to me, J.K. Rowling, as in bowling, that's how you pronounce the name, but don't apologise to me, apologise to
they're not going to apologise to her because they disagree with her.
But
we believe in free speech. We believe in freedom of expression. They're all able to have different opinions. The point is, the Cass review that was published this week by Dr. Hilary Cass, this report effectively has showed that actually in the United Kingdom, the issues that we're facing within the NHS are effectively that children that are being prescribed these hormone blockers, children that are being medicalised, sterilised as children, are actually not being benefited. The intended effect isn't
there. It's very dangerous ideology and work on that premise.
They're being let down. Yeah. And so J.K. Rowling, coming here.
She can say it any way she wants.
I can say it. I'm free speech.
Once again, this is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
J.K. Rowling has actually come out and said, you know, she's been defending human rights.
But as you and I spoke about in the green room, the way she's gone about it is not necessary.
Yeah.
And people are welcome to disagree with the fact that she took 10 people. She took journalists. She took people that are completely innocent. Conflated them with sexual predators and said, oh, they're all men, etc. I get why.
But she's allowed to do that.
Of course she's allowed. Yeah. Of course she's allowed to do that. But also people like the people who've worked with her, like Daniel Radcliffe, etc., are allowed to say, no, we don't agree with
that. They can. But what has he done he done since Harry Potter?
He's done quite a lot.
But absolutely nothing that anybody cares about. Harry Potter is what he knows. It's absolutely true. Finally, one for the teenagers. Keir Starmer, Labour will hike UK defence spending amid threat from China and Russia.
Yes,
he's really pushing the boat out now, isn't he, Starmer?
He's gone
from nuclear disarmament under old Jeremy Corbyn to building up our defences. No,
and as always,
2.5% of GDP, which I think is really interesting that Sunak, has failed to do that themselves. Somehow, Starmer seems to think he's going to find the money in the budget.
Yeah.
My question is, where is this money going to come from?
There is no money tree. This is what they said, isn't
well,
it?
Rishi Sunak's pandemic money tree. No.
Yeah. But no, I agree.
There's branches to spare.
No, but you know where that money came from, Sam? It came from money printing.
Exactly.
That's why we saw double-digit inflation last year. Yeah. So I'd rather us not return to that kind of economic
strategy. Starmer says defence is the number one issue for his government.
Yes.
I mean, next week it'll be something else.
Let's just give the man a chance.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'd rather not, but I think we're going to have to. That's all you've got from me tonight. You've been watching The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Thank you to all of you for arguing so well. Plank of the Week, back tomorrow night at 7 on Real Talk TV.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.